Welcome to this week's edition of the 2 Degrees Show, except we're taking the unusual step of abandoning our programme title just two episodes into the series. It's become apparent that 2 degrees centigrade can no longer be regarded as a safe target level of global average temperature rise. Despite its adoption by the European Union in 2005, it appears increasingly that this target is the result of political compromise, rather than what is actually likely to safeguard our natural environment. New work by US top climate scientist and director of NASA, Dr. James Hansen, now suggests that we need to stabilise levels of CO2 in the atmosphere at a level lower than it is today. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere today is around 387 parts per million. Hansen and his team suggest that the safe level is somewhere between 300 and 350 parts per million. It is for this reason that we are renaming the programme the 300 to 350 show. In doing so, we are partly tipping our hat to a new campaign led by Bill McKibben in the United States to raise the profile of the number 350 in the public consciousness. But we also go further and acknowledge that the detail of James Hansen's work suggests that if we wanted to get back the Arctic ice, for example, we might need to stabilise CO2 at an even lower level. These new targets have dramatic implications. We now need to phase out our use of fossil fuels completely, not just by 2050, but as fast as we possibly can. As well as ensuring that we are no longer adding to the CO2 in the atmosphere, we also need to use good forestry and agricultural practices to take additional CO2 out of the atmosphere. The time for political compromise with vested interests is over. Over the last 6 months, James Hansen has written, in a personal capacity, to different heads of state, emphasising his scientific understanding that, quote, "the urgent stopgap essential action to save the planet is a moratorium on new coal." The first letter James Hansen sent was to British Prime Minister Gordon Brown back in December 2007. Hansen implored our Prime Minister to take a lead in instituting a moratorium on new coal developments. He offered Gordon Brown an opportunity to show, quote, "leadership that could change the course of human history." The letter is both powerful and historic, and worth quoting at length. "Your leadership is needed on a matter concerning coal-fired power plants in your country. A matter with ramifications for life on our planet, including all species. Prospects for today's children, and especially the world's poor, hinge upon our success in stabilising climate. A decision to phase out coal use, unless the CO2 is captured, is a global imperative if we are to preserve the wonders of nature, our coastlines, and our social and economic well-being. If Great Britain and Germany halted construction of coal-fired power plants that do not capture and sequester the CO2, it could be a tipping point for the world. There is still time to find that tipping point, but just barely. You have the potential to influence the future of the planet. If we continue to build coal-fired power plants without carbon capture, we will lock in future climate disasters associated with passing climate tipping points. We must solve the coal problem now." Hansen targeted Britain and Germany because, along with the US, the three countries have contributed most to the fossil fuel CO2 in the air today on a per capita basis. Surely, as a country priding itself as a leader in efforts to tackle climate change, Gordon Brown would have jumped at the chance to take a lead in this regard. But so far, the response appears to be one of silence. Even worse, we have an energy white paper which commits us to maximising economic recovery from our remaining coal reserves. And there is the possibility that after a 30-year hiatus, 7 new coal-fired power stations could be given planning permission in the UK. Later in the programme, we'll be hearing from Australia about the climate camp that has just finished there, which culminated in the country's biggest direct action so far against the country's coal exporting industry. But first, here's Leila Dean from the World Development Movement, who are one of the many NGOs that are now supporting the campaign against what would be the first new coal-fired power station in the UK for 30 years, at Kingsnorth in Kent. James Hansen seemed to lay it on the line. He sent a letter to Prime Minister back in December saying there's a historic opportunity there for the UK to take a lead and back a moratorium on new coal, and that might really be the thing which can create this kind of tipping point in terms of political response to climate change and dealing with climate change. What has the Prime Minister's response been to that?
I'm not sure if the Prime Minister responded to James Hansen himself, but I think at the moment the UK government seems to be working on the premise that if they ignore it, it will go away. And what they're now realising is that there is a growing global movement specifically targeting coal as a main cause of climate change. And actually, historically, coal is responsible for 50% of all the human-induced carbon emissions in the atmosphere, which is something that James Hansen points out. So, yeah, across the world, people are seeing coal as a big problem. And I think the UK government, especially with Climate Camp happening, but also all the NGOs getting involved in the campaign against Kingsolve Power Station, are realising that actually they're going to have some kind of a response to this idea that we don't need coal anymore. And that's yet to come from them. The only person that is championing a resistance to putting a moratorium on coal really is the business minister John Hutton, who is very gung-ho about having 7 new coal-fired power stations in the UK. The other members of government at the moment haven't said anything about it, apart from Alistair Darling, who did himself comment on carbon capture and storage as something that wouldn't be available in the time we need it to be available. But otherwise, I suspect that the government will have to start taking a line on whether they believe in an eventual coal moratorium or not, but at the moment they're hiding from that and they haven't done that.
There hasn't been a new coal-fired power station in this country for 30 years, mm-hmm. so this will be the first if it happens. Mm. Hansen is saying coal-fired generation is fine if it has carbon capture and storage. Kingsnorth won't have carbon capture and storage.
No, and that's the real irony. Whilst our government, alongside all the major governments in the world now, has recognised that climate change is happening, and our government is saying that they would like to be leaders in stopping climate change, they are at the same time trying to build 7 new coal-fired power stations. And the only way that they are able to be saying that is by saying, oh yes, carbon capture and storage or clean coal technology, one of these things will save us from continued rising carbon emissions. Both of those ideas are really a load of rubbish, quite frankly, because, you know, even the cleanest form of coal is still the dirtiest way that we generate energy. So coal is dirtier than oil and gas, and that's something that always surprises people. And what they're saying is that we can use newer technology which makes coal more efficient, so the amount of energy you get from coal is increased compared to the amount of carbon dioxide it produces, compared to 30 years ago. But still, we're talking about the dirtiest form of energy. So even with this new technology, it's still committing massive climate crime, I suppose. At Kingsnorth, they're going to build a 1600 megawatt power station. And what they're saying is that this power station will be 20% more efficient. So for each hour of power, it produces less carbon dioxide than it used to. However, it's a much bigger power station, so the overall amount of carbon dioxide it will produce when it's fired up properly is more. So actually, it's an increase in carbon dioxide, and that's rubbish. So then you've got carbon capture and storage. Now, I don't think that anyone who cares about climate change would suggest that we should rule out a technology like carbon capture and storage. Yes, we definitely want it. We want to see if it works, and hopefully it can be used to capture a lot of carbon from power stations once it's been proved to work. But the thing is that it's a total red herring at the moment, because it hasn't been proved. It's never been used on an industrial level, let alone at the scale that it would need to be used at Kingsnorth. The current Kingsnorth power station is not promising any kind of carbon capture and storage. It's not even promising to be carbon capture ready, which in itself is a load of nonsense, because all carbon capture readiness means is that they would have room to fit some technology, if some technology eventually exists which can capture carbon. So it's not even promising the bare minimum. Like, it's not even expressing a suggestion that it cares about environmental issues in that sense.
And the government isn't requiring it either.
No, and the government isn't requiring it. And actually, there was some emails that were released by Greenpeace recently which showed that one of the government ministers had said to an E.ON employee that he was working with, oh, isn't this application supposed to have carbon capture and storage readiness in it somewhere? And the E.ON employee said, no, we would find that unacceptable. And so the application still doesn't have carbon capture and storage. And that's how much E.ON is controlling this process and how collusive the government is being with E.ON. So whilst the government is not requiring that or anticipating that at King's North to have carbon capture and storage, publicly they're saying, oh, coal-fired power stations will be okay because we'll have carbon capture and storage. But we don't have it. And they're planning to approve power stations without carbon capture and storage. And the reality of that is that if you build power stations that are without that technology from the outset, then if it ever becomes available, we're already facing catastrophic climate change by the time it becomes available. But if it becomes available, it's going to be the public that has to pay for that. It's not going to be the companies that have to fit it. The only way it would get fitted eventually is by the government putting it on power stations. Even Alistair Darling has said we will not see carbon capture and storage technology available until at least 2020. And that doesn't take account of the fact that it won't be economically viable for much longer than that. Because actually, carbon capture and storage is really, really expensive, and it reduces the efficiency of a power station even more. So we don't know this, but we estimate that if a company really thought it was going to have to put carbon capture and storage on its power station, it wouldn't bother investing in the power station because its energy would no longer be competitive. Because actually, by the time all of that's happening, renewable energy will be much cheaper. So they have no intention of really utilising carbon capture and storage in their plans. And if they're made to do it, they won't pay for it. It'll be the government that pays for it. So you can see that it doesn't exist now. Even if it did exist, it would be the public having to pay an awful lot of money for it. And all the time we're having this conversation, what we're not talking about is renewable energy that is cheaper to put up, that is available today, and that can provide a great deal of energy for us. So it's a shame that carbon capture and storage, a good idea, is being used as such a white elephant in this context, because what it means is that we're not getting anywhere on what we really need to do, and we have very little time to do that.
Perhaps some clarity around the timeline. I mean, the government has got this competition for a carbon capture and storage demonstration plant.
Yeah.
What's the timeline on that? When would that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that superficially makes us feel like there's something different about King's North, because King's North has been entered in the carbon capture and storage competition that the government's running. And this competition will basically see one power station as the test site for new technology. So when people hear that, they think, oh, okay, so King's North will have carbon capture and storage, even if all the other ones don't. And even if it's only for research, it will happen. Well, even if it wins that competition, the carbon capture and storage that it will use will be for 300 megawatts. And as I said before, King's North is 1600.
That's only a small proportion of its...
Yeah. So what we think we're looking at is 80% of the carbon dioxide that's coming out of it anyway, without carbon capture and storage, will still be coming out of it once it has this test site, if it wins this competition.
Which won't be until...
They can test carbon capture and storage technology now. So if King's North won the competition, then as part of their rebuild, they would fit this technology. So at the moment, the power station looks set to take 4 years to rebuild. So in 4 years, we might see them testing a small carbon capture and storage unit there. But as I say, even when that's active, it'll only be capturing about 20% at most, maybe 15% of the carbon.
How advanced are all the other coal-fired power stations that the government's been talking about as well? And they're in the planning pipeline? Or?
They are, but they're all sitting very, very quiet. There are six others that the companies have expressed a desire to build. However, none of them are really moving forward, apart from the next one in the pipeline, which is Tilbury. But the company behind that plant is watching very, very carefully what's going on with E.ON. RWE Thames are planning to build that plant, and Tilbury was mentioned in the context of King's North Power Station on Radio Kent recently, and the World Development Movement received some very irate phone calls from RWE Thames saying, don't mention Tilbury in the context of King's North Power Station. That's how anxious they are. So they're very aware that if King's North goes through, then they've got the all clear. And until that happens, I don't think that we'll see any of them even attempt to get permission to build, because they want to see if King's North will get permission to build. Having said that, if King's North goes ahead, you know, and gets permission, and which it may well do in October, November time, and then wins the carbon capture competition, then the next power station will be Tilbury, and that they will try and move that forward really, really quickly whilst everyone's still looking at King's North. But they can rest assured that there are a lot of people that are already watching Tilbury and that are very willing to take action to stop that one as well.
I think the main thing is that Hanson's arguing for this moratorium.
Yeah.
No new coal without CCS, and that's not what King's North is offering.
No, not at all. I think the coal moratorium is one way to go, and that would be brilliant if you got that. I think the other thing that we would also be very interested in hearing from the government is about a minimum efficiency standard for power stations, which is something that the Tories and the Lib Dems have said that they would support, although neither of them are really talking about an efficiency standard that's tight enough. However, an efficiency standard that basically said a power station can only emit X amount of emissions in order for it to be built would be a really good first step, and one that was tight enough would rule out King's North. Basically, the thing about King's North and the thing about coal-fired power stations is they're extremely inefficient. So for all of the energy that King's North Power Station generates, only one third of that goes back into the grid. So it's an extremely inefficient way of generating energy.
So heat loss?
Yeah, the rest of the energy goes out in heat. And that's why a lot of us are championing the idea of combined heat and power at the very minimum, which would essentially, a combined heat and power plant uses the heat as a form of energy, so you don't lose those two thirds anymore. So it wouldn't be hard with a decent efficiency standard to rule out something like King's North and something and most coal-fired power stations. There is a way to make coal-fired power stations more efficient, and you know, carbon capture and storage would be one of those. But actually, as I said, I think if a company knew that it was building a coal power station that it was going to have to put CCS on in order to achieve a standard, then it wouldn't build the coal-fired power stations, because it's better off investing in something else. So that's another way that it could potentially pan out, rather than there being a moratorium on coal. I suppose the other thing we haven't touched on is the whole energy gap thing.
Yeah, the idea that John Hutton will argue about energy security, we need to keep the kind of base load up or whatever it is.
Yeah, and it, you know, it is completely farcical. The idea that the lights would go off is absolute nonsense. There's no way a government would allow the lights to go off. And at the moment, what we're talking about is taking off coal-fired power stations that have to close because they're not meeting EU directives anymore. And the issue is, do we replace those with new coal-fired power stations, or do we replace those with something else? Now, they're saying we have to have coal-fired power stations so the lights don't go off. At the same time, they're promising to build so much renewable energy that we can get 40% of our electricity from renewables.
By 2020.
If we had that much renewable energy, we would be well over what we need. And that's not to say that we wouldn't need coal-fired power stations, because obviously we would have existing power stations still running, we'd have existing gas stations and oil stations. Looking into the future, we need to start shutting some of those existing ones down too, because we need to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions. But the way that power stations work is that they can be kept off until there's an emergency. So yes, we can run on renewables, and yes, we can maintain some kind of base load, which will be fossil fuel. But because it's something we only need in an emergency, it's something that actually won't be emitting a great deal of carbon emissions on a regular basis. So the idea that we need new coal-fired power stations so that the lights don't go off is absolutely farcical, and it's scaremongering, and it's really, really irresponsible.
That was Leila Dean from the World Development Movement, one of the many civil society organisations, including the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds and Christian Aid, that are now supporting the campaign against a new coal-fired power station at King's North in Kent. As Leila mentioned in that interview, the global movement to resist new coal developments is a rapidly growing one. Earlier this week, I spoke to Georgina Woods, a media rep for Australia's first Camp for Climate Action, which culminated in a mass action involving around 1,000 people last Sunday. I mean, it seems quite historic to have a climate camp in Newcastle. Why was Newcastle targeted? Why did you think that was a good place for the camp to be?
Well, we chose Newcastle because Newcastle is the world's biggest coal exporting port. We export around 80 or 90 million tonnes of coal from Newcastle every year to be burnt overseas in power stations, and it's Australia's single biggest contribution to climate change.
So what's the experience of the camp been like over the last week?
The camp has been a really powerful experience of the power of non-violent protest action in social change. We've been holding workshops and forums about climate change and about non-violent direct action. We've been hearing about how coal-dependent communities like ours in Hunter Valley in New South Wales and Australia and other coal-dependent communities in Australia can transition away from coal dependence and into other industries. And it all culminated on Sunday with the biggest single direct action protest against coal and climate change that Australia has ever seen, with a 1,000-strong march marching on the Carrington Coal Terminal, which is part of the Newcastle port, and stopping trains heading into that terminal for around 6 or 7 hours, with probably about 50 people ending up being arrested for putting themselves in front of the trains to stop them getting through.
And there was more actions today as well?
Yep, this morning around 10 activists went into the Kooragang Coal Terminal, which is the other main terminal here in Newcastle in the coal port, and attached themselves to the coal loading equipment. They did that to stop the coal from being loaded at Kooragang, because every hour here in Newcastle, thousands of tonnes of coal are loaded, which creates thousands of tonnes of carbon dioxide when burned overseas. And then in the evening of the same day, another group of young people occupied the coal train line that heads into Carrington, so we had another disruption to the port's activities. So all in all, three quite effective disruptions to the coal loading facilities at the port.
It seems like awareness of climate change issues is kind of racing up the agenda in Australia, and the impacts on Australia are becoming quite profound. Is awareness of the camp also penetrating the national media as well?
Yeah, climate change is a mainstream issue in Australia, largely because of our drought. We have been experiencing drought for a number of years now, and our National Science Organisation have recently released a report showing that in a climate-changing world, we are going to be experiencing more and more severe droughts. And that's something that everyday Australians are worried about because of the availability of drinking water here. The problem has always been that while we have been able to talk about climate change and about national emissions trading schemes and other potential avenues for reducing emissions domestically, we've never really been able to raise coal exporting and its role in fueling climate change as a major mainstream topic. That is why Climate Camp chose to target coal exports, because we needed to throw open the debate about the role of coal exports in fueling climate change. And the action that we've taken as part of Climate Camp has drawn the attention of the world and the whole country to this issue and has really turned around the climate change conversation in Australia.
And the new report that's come out recently, what's the effect of that been?
The Ghana report raises a lot of really important questions for Australia, particularly our role internationally. Unfortunately, it doesn't really address the need to reduce coal exports and our economic dependence on that, but it does talk about coal being Australia's single biggest problem and biggest contribution to climate change. It really is a debate that mainstream Australia is quite engaged in, and obviously that's a really good thing, and it has, I guess, in some ways allowed us to take it a step further and engage the country also in conversations about coal, because at the moment we have an inherent contradiction, because we have a government that is talking as if it is willing to take effective action on climate change, but it is committed to expanding the coal export industry, and those two positions are antithetical, and we just can't maintain them.
Okay, in terms of making that just transition from coal dependency in terms of the economy to a lower carbon economy, you're emphasising the jobs that are to be had by investing in renewable technologies?
Yeah, one of the big concerns for people living in communities in Australia that are currently dependent on the coal industry is that unless our government takes responsibility now for a strategy to wean ourselves off coal and invest in other industries, those communities are really going to be left behind as the world moves beyond the Kyoto Protocol into the next emissions reductions framework and begins to move to low carbon technology. So Greenpeace Australia in the last couple of weeks have released a report showing that there are thousands of jobs to be created in the renewable industries, but what is required is some investment in those industries and encouragement of those industries from governments. That's what's been missing so far, and I think that it's really important to show coal-dependent communities in Australia that there are alternative industries that can provide employment and wealth without fueling global climate change.
I understand there's about 30 new open cast mines proposed in Australia as well?
Well, there's about a dozen or 13 new mines proposed just in this region alone, in the Hunter in New South Wales. There are many more being opened up in Queensland and in Victoria and in Western Australia. So it's a rapidly expanding industry. Australia is really recklessly expanding its coal export industry at a time when carbon is obviously under a serious question as a fuel for energy. We here in the Hunter have a government that are wedded to the coal export industry and the money that they make from it. And unfortunately, that's holding us back from embracing the kinds of opportunities that we could have if we started investing in renewable energy technologies.
Finally, what was the makeup of the people that attended the camp? Was it a cross-section of people?
Yeah, well, we have people from all over the country. Australia is a very wide country, and we have people from Western Australia, South Australia, Darwin, Tasmania. There were lots and lots of parents and grandparents. I know one family that had three generations all together at climate camp. There were professional people, there were students, there were coal miners and unionists. And we really, I think, had an amazing experience of shared purpose among people that came from quite diverse backgrounds.
And do you think we're going to see more direct action on coal in Australia as well?
Yeah, I think that Climate Camp has been a turning point in the protest movement in Australia. A lot of people have been talking today about going back to their communities where they come from in other states of Australia and building the protest movement, because we have so much to lose and we have so little time and we can't afford to vacillate anymore. We need to tackle the coal industry, we need to get our greenhouse gas emissions down, and we need to do it in a cooperative and effective way.
That was Georgina Woods from the Camp for Climate Action in Newcastle, New South Wales. There are half a dozen or so other climate camps around the world this summer, including three in the US and one in Hamburg in Germany. The UK Camp for Climate Action will be targeting the proposed new coal-fired power station at King's North in Kent. The camp takes place from the 3rd to the 11th of August, and there's a caravan of people setting off by foot, wheel and water from Heathrow Airport on 27th of July and arriving at the camp on the 3rd of August. Full details can be found at www.climatecamp.org.uk. We'll continue our look at coal next week and hopefully speak to a minister of the UK government to find out why they appear to be putting the interests of business above the interests of the environment at what clearly is a make or break point. In the meantime, you can find references and links relating to this week's programme on the Climate Radio Archive, which is now up to date again after a slight delay. There you can also listen to this week's show again or any others you may have missed. You can find the archive at www.climateradio.co.uk.